Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Love is a Choice, the definitive book on letting go of unhealthy relationships. By Dr. Robert Hemfelt, Dr. Frank Minerth, and Dr. Paul Meyer. Narrated by Christopher Solomini. Part 1. What Codependency Is. Chapter 1. The Thread That Runs So True. Gladys Jordan perched on the edge of the chair, with her feet squarely under her, as if she were ready to bolt. Her gnarled fingers laced in and out of each other, paused to draw a strand of graying hair out of her eyes, then resumed their anxious movement. Her fact sheet said she was 53. She looked 65. In the chair beside her, her husband John crossed his arms and sat back with a scowl. A stocky, powerful man, he was by no means fat, but he'd been eating well. 54 years of sun had crinkled up his eyes and tanned his skin. A contractor by trade, he enjoyed a spotless reputation for always coming in under bid and on time. "I'm here because Gladys wanted me to come," he announced. "I don't think a psychologist can help. It's too late." John Jordan didn't soften. "We understood from years of experience the unspoken objections behind John Jordan's guarded attitude. So we admitted that to him. You may well feel that being here today is wrong," we said. "Seeking help from a psychologist or psychiatrist says that you're too weak to straighten things out yourself. Perhaps you have no common sense, because that's all psychology is. After all, healthy people control their attitudes and emotions at all times. Are we close?" "That's right. John, I understand you built your contracting firm from scratch. Started right out of high school with a used pickup." "How many trucks do you run now?"
"7 pickups,
2 dumps, a couple of vans, a front-end loader, and a blade." There was an edge of pride in John's voice, justifiable, healthy pride. "I see. Too bad you're not stronger. If you were strong enough, you wouldn't need all those expensive tools. You could carry the load yourself, level sights with a shovel." John's face was a beauty to behold. His expression shifted from confusion to realization, the aha, light bulb going on look, to a sly twinkle. That twinkle was the first feeble sign that his hostility might be softening a bit, but the twinkle faded quickly. "I see your point. Counseling is a tool, but it still ends up the same. If I could just sit down and talk sense into myself, or if my faith were greater, we wouldn't be here." "That's not so. You don't move mountains with a word. You use a greater, not because your faith is lacking, but because it's the way it's done here on earth. We want to help you and your wife move a mountain." "Gladys, 31 years of marriage, 3 children, 2 boys and a girl. I assume they're out on their own now. What are they doing?" we asked. Her voice rasped, as tight and jittery as her body. "John Jr. got his B.A. in business and started a dry cleaning business. He says it takes a lot of time and work, but he's doing very well. Marcia is an ER nurse at St. Joseph's Emergency Room. She likes lots of action, you know? She deals well with pressure, and James is..." She licked her lips. "He's had some problems, but he's in detox now, and he'll do just fine." "John, we understand your faith is very important to both of you. Divorce is not an option, right? You may have considered murder, but not divorce." The corners of the contractor's mouth turned up, more a grimace than a smile.
You got that right.
The non-smile melted away, and at last a true softening crept into his voice.
Talk about incompatibility, irreconcilable differences. That's us, constantly. Marriage is supposed to be made in heaven. Ours sure wasn't. If divorce were an option, if we had the choice, one of us would have walked out years ago.
Gladys's features tightened. If we had the choice.
She didn't have to use the word trapped. It was etched on her sad face. Her hands had not ceased moving since she sat down.
John doesn't listen. He doesn't even try to hear what I say. It's so frustrating trying to get through a brick wall.
John countered. She's not talking about communication. Communication is discussing good as well as bad. Everything she says is critical. In her eyes, I can't do or say anything right. Whatever I provide, she wants more or different. It's never the right thing, never good enough.
There was no joy in the Jordans' marriage and their lives. The din of their constant friction had drowned out the quiet peace of a happy life. Here, on chairs positioned 6 feet apart, sat the ultimate tragedy. Two good, sincere people wanting only to love each other. And they could not. Through the Jordans' lives, perhaps through yours as well, runs a common thread causing untold misery and unhappiness. It tugs and pulls at their subconscious. It affects their judgment and robs them of choice, even as they falsely believe they are choosing intelligently and well. That strand has been labeled codependency. Codependency. In its broadest sense, codependency can be defined as an addiction to people, behaviors, or things. Codependency is the fallacy of trying to control interior feelings by controlling people, things, and events on the outside. To the codependent, control, or the lack of it, is central to every aspect of life. The codependent may be addicted to another person. In this interpersonal codependency, the codependent has become so elaborately enmeshed in the other person that the sense of self, personal identity, is severely restricted, crowded out by that other person's identity and problems. Additionally, codependents can be like a vacuum cleaner gone wild, drawing to themselves not just another person, but also chemicals, alcohol or drugs primarily, or things, money, food, sexuality, work. They struggle relentlessly to fill the great emotional vacuum within themselves. Our patients have described it as walking around feeling like the hole in the center of the donut. There is something missing inside me. Support groups. Codependency was first recognized several decades ago as counselors endeavored to help alcoholics and their families. In the vanguard of this movement was Alcoholics Anonymous. The founders of AA observed several things about alcoholics. They were deeply embittered toward God. They were rebellious, independent, and at the same time they were childishly dependent upon those around them. Although the first AA workers themselves knew God intimately, they felt that in some way they had to sidestep this bitterness toward God by using the phrase, God as I understand him, in their now famous 12 steps. Their intention was to focus on the need for outside help. The alcoholic addiction was fought inch by inch, day by day, through application of the steps and attendance at meetings with fellow alcoholics. AA was successful in rescuing alcoholics, but there was serious fallout.
The families were coming apart within a year after the alcoholics dried out. Workers realized that just as the alcoholic was dependent upon his or her alcohol, the family very frequently had become just as dependent upon the alcoholism. They had adjusted not only their whole lives, but also their whole way of perceiving life to accommodate the alcoholic. They enabled that person to keep the habit up. They denied. They ignored. They circumvented. To the kids especially, this warped life with an alcoholic parent was normal. It was all they knew. The alcoholic was dependent upon the alcohol. The family was codependent upon alcoholism along with the alcoholic. Thus was born the term. Al-Anon and Alateen were developed not to aid the alcoholic, but those close to him. The program was designed to restructure the codependent's way of seeing the world, of unwarping him or her, if you will, to facilitate adjustment to a brand new family dynamic. The concept of dependency and codependency is no longer limited to alcohol. It takes in the rest of the chemical spectrum: coke, pot, tobacco, heroin, and beyond. The beyond includes nearly any obsessive compulsion, a thing or a behavior carried to excess. Eating disorders, for example, anorexia or bulimia, sex addiction, rageaholism, workaholism, the compulsion to spend and spend, an extremely rigid and legalistic approach to living, the compulsion to wash one's hands 55 times a day. These and other addictions have been placed in the same class as alcoholism. These disorders and others affect the family and close associates, the codependents, who may suffer as severely as the dependent or more so. The concept of codependency embraces the alcoholic also. The word codependent literally means dependent with. People sometimes think of the spouse of the alcoholic as being the only codependent. Not so. The alcoholic himself or herself is actively codependent. His or her dependency is with a thing, alcohol. The spouse is dependent upon a person, the alcoholic, and upon the nature of the relationship as the spouse helps and enables the alcoholic. The two are equally dependent upon each other, codependent. The ultimate tragedy. Another tragedy, with which we will deal in later chapters, is a problem of multi-generational nature. The serious dysfunction in a founding family will be absorbed by the children's families, and then their children's families, a ripple of misery extending farther and farther down through the years. The dependency or dysfunction may change. An alcoholic father may sire, for instance, a workaholic son, who sires a compulsive daughter, who spends her way to bankruptcy. But it's there. It's almost always there, wreaking its damage. At the clinic, we treat many codependents, people with obsessive-compulsive behavior, their spouses and children, and children of dysfunctional families. Statisticians estimate that at least 15 million Americans are alcoholic or drug dependent. We believe each alcoholic severely impacts at least four other significant people, such as spouses, children, and coworkers. Potentially, 60 million codependents suffer from the addiction of those 15 million Americans. In addition, it is estimated that about 28 million Americans are the adult children of alcoholics and still suffer from the codependency they experienced in their childhoods. And that's just alcohol. these figures do not address codependency generated by addictions and compulsions other than chemical abuse. They are, therefore, extremely conservative. The actual numbers of all codependents are much, much higher. Epidemic. There's no other way to describe it. When roughly 100 million Americans across two concurrent generations suffer problems of codependency, we are embattled by an epidemic of staggering degree. The unhappiness, despair, and wasted life lie beyond comprehension. Thousands of the patients at the Minerth Clinic and Meyer New Life Clinics throughout the country are codependents, and each of us counsels them, either as a psychiatrist, Dr. Frank Minerth and Dr. Paul Meyer, or as a psychologist, Dr. Robert Helmfelt. The goal of counsel is twofold: to ease the immediate problems caused by codependency, and to prevent damage in the future, both to the codependents and to the generations following. You stand a 1 in 4 chance of suffering from problems caused by codependency. What problems? Divorce and relationship difficulties, substance abuse, compulsive behaviors you can't seem to control, anger beyond reason, depression, and more. These are massive problems, recurring problems, problems that undermine your happiness and make life dismal. What about you? Is codependency at the root of your unhappiness? And more important, if so, can it somehow be expunged to ease the misery? There are two important reasons why you should examine your life and correct problems of codependency if they exist. One is to improve your own life, making it more manageable and controlled, and avoiding serious mistakes. The other reason is the children, both yours and those around you. The impact of codependency, remember, is multi-generational. Problems in this generation warp the next and condemn those following unless the cycle is broken. One of the most moving comments we heard came from a young woman in therapy. "I'm not sure I'll ever fully achieve peace and happiness, but I've saved my children from this pain." The Jordans needed the guiding hand of a trained counselor to unravel their tangled marital knot. We showed them what we as impartial observers could see. In this book, we will walk you through that same process. In part 2, we will explore the causes of codependency, unmet emotional needs, lost childhood, and the compulsion to fix the dysfunctional family. You'll see how we brought each of the Jordans to terms with the past. They analyzed it, raged about it, grieved over it, made peace with it. As you watch the Jordans deal with these issues, weigh their situation against your own personal circumstances. In part 3, we'll examine the factors that lock codependents, like the Jordans, in a perpetual cycle of pain, the snowball effect of addiction, their denial, and their anger. Most of the thoughts and factors influencing the codependent's life are either buried, ignored, or unrecognized. We'll uncover them. Next, in part 4, we'll help you examine how codependency influences your relationships and how you can halt the destructive tapes playing in your mind. Finally, we'll take you stage by stage through the sometimes painful, sometimes exhilarating steps to recovery. Discoveries of driving forces you never realized you had will emerge as you inventory your past. Anger will boil. Grief will work its healing. New choices and new directions will take you farther than you ever dreamed. It won't be easy. Today, the Jordans do not float airily through an idyllic existence. Their healing is much more profound and practical. John is still a workaholic, but he's aware of it now and compensates. Gladys understands better her place in the marriage. Most important, they know the ways in which the past drove them, and they are learning to circumvent those driving forces that once ruled so cruelly. For the first time in their lives, John and Gladys are tasting real happiness. Much depends upon your desire to free yourself from the ghosts of your own past. The children in your life will benefit, perhaps immeasurably. Your own happiness and ability to genuinely love hinge on the decisions you make now. Let's begin by looking at the 10 traits of a codependent. Chapter 2. The Way Codependency Works. He was a Depression-era kid, 7 years old in 1929, when the stocks took their fatal plunge. "See," his old man said, "never put faith in money, Jerry boy." His father, Phil Braley, didn't either. Whatever Phil Braley earned was spent within 24 hours. Same with his wife, Maud. Phil was never actually out of work, as were so many then. He remained fairly steadily employed as a delivery truck driver. Maud kept a little garden in her Los Angeles backyard and sometimes took in laundry. But no matter how much money she made, she never had any. Her wages disappeared as fast as Phil's. From age 9 on, only son Jerry Braley was never without a paying job. One of his best-paying jobs didn't last long. A covert cell of anarchists hired him to stuff political pamphlets under people's front doors after dark. The group was arrested, and Jerry went on to more mundane jobs, sweeping floors, delivering papers and phone books, hawking oranges door to door. Whenever he passed the Western Auto Store, he'd check out the bikes. At first he wanted the red flyer with the mock tank on the crossbars and the pinstriping on the fenders. Then he didn't care whether it had any extras. Eventually, he didn't care what color it was. He wanted a bike, any bike. He hungered. He yearned. And yet, for all the years he worked, he never accumulated enough money to buy a bike. His money always went to something the family needed when Dad was between paydays. In high school, Jerry was very competitive and excelled in athletics. At home, he excelled in keeping creditors at bay. The family shopped at two local grocery stores and had accounts past due at both. Jerry would try one. If they refused to let him run up the bill further, he'd reshelve his purchases, highly embarrassed, and try the other store. His family never owned a house or phone. Jerry was so ashamed of their rentals that when he got a ride home from school, he'd get dropped off two blocks away. He painfully feared that someone would learn where he really lived. Jill's family coped with the insecurity and tight money of the Depression in just the opposite way. She, too, was 7 when the market crashed. Her father, too, managed to remain employed throughout the Depression, for he was a splendid carpenter. There the similarity ended. Phil Braley was a genial, laid-back, easygoing guy, ever ready to lend you a buck if he had it. Jill's father, Peter Winthrop, a tense and thundering rageaholic, hoarded every dime. Jill's family, like Jerry's, did without, but not because of spendthrift ways. Just the opposite. Money that should have gone for family needs went into the savings account instead. Belt tightening eased and the country moved into war and prosperity. Phil Braley still never had a dime, and Peter Winthrop still hoarded every dime. Economic circumstances changed. The two families didn't. Jerry grew into a handsome man, mature and poised. He was a little late starting a family because he served in Korea and spent several years building a brokerage. During the war, Jill rose from clerk to director of the Los Angeles County Public Safety Office. A born manager, her superiors called her. When Jill and Jerry met, it was love at first sight. Handsome bachelor, wedded dark, slim beauty. As the years passed, Jerry amassed a chain of grocery stores and a major interest in a local bank. He's now worth in excess of $55 million. No Scrooge. He's an affable people lover who spends well and frequently. He knows where to put his charity dollars and whom to trust. He knows how to live well. Jill changed, too, her friends say. She always had responded to frightening or problematic situations by tightening control and screaming a lot. But instead of mellowing, she just kept getting worse. A compulsive cleaner, she hollered whenever Jerry or their only child, Bill, disturbed her tidiness by the mere act of living in the house. She criticized happy old Jerry every time he spent a dime, which was often, and her constant extreme dieting was starting to threaten her health. Jill and Jerry came into our clinic recently, not for themselves, but for their son. Bill, at 36, was the pride and the bane of their existence. Jerry wagged his head sadly. We gave the boy everything we could. If he wanted something, it was his. The best schools, the best home, everything. It's as if he has turned on us, and yet he hasn't. All I know is something has to be done, and he's not about to do it himself. We're here hoping you can tell us how to reach him, how to get him straightened out before he ruins his life and our grandkids' lives. Tell us about Bill. Jill grimaced, a tight prune face. He majored in business administration in college. Jerry planned to give him the reins of the corporation someday after he built up the necessary experience. A month before he was supposed to graduate from Yale, he went into the Peace Corps, or whatever they call it now. Lived like some bum in South America. I forget which country he went to. Jerry chimed in. But he only lasted a couple of months over there. He came home, went back to school, and took an interest in the business. A year later, he flew to Boston with a woman. Lived with her about 8 months. Jill's lips tightened into a thin, white line. She was, of a different background. Different socioeconomic status. She was everything you hope and pray your son will never run into. We can't imagine what possessed him to get involved with her. It's the worst, most horrible thing he could ever do. Then he met Karen, Jerry continued. Sweet girl. Goes to our church. Really a very nice girl. They have 3 children and a lovely home. The children go to a private school, a very good school. You'd think he would be content at last. He works for your company? Yes. He's senior vice president. I'm grooming him to take over. If Jerry was proud of him, why did the voice sound so sad? Why did you come to see us, exactly? Jill looked like a storm at sea. Everything about her demeanor was bleak. He's a, I guess you'd call him a sexaholic. Runs around on Karen constantly, with some of the most repulsive women you'd ever meet. I hesitate to call him depraved, but that's very close to it. And he gambles. Jerry sounded so weary. Compulsive gambler.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?